So all of you who have contributed 500 rupees are entitled to take a chapter from the Origin of Species from the table.
And this one.
And if you didn't get a blue book last time, then your blue book is here today. So much material to share with you, I don't know where to begin. I have one here. You won't need it today. Just as a kind of historical note, and this is the historical phase of our course, Ernst Mayr's book, What Evolution Is, which was written at the age of 97, I think, on 2001, was followed by a posthumous publication titled One Wrong Argument. And if you look at your handout, which is the last chapter of The Origin of Species, you will see that in the top line of that article, Darwin says that it is just one long argument. And it's still one long argument. Ernst Mayr doesn't actually do anything in this book except exemplify and expand upon and emphasize Darwin's original arguments. And by expanding upon them, I mean he adds all the modern scientific information that supports those original ideas. So it's quite interesting actually to read Mayr in relation to Darwin, because it's like Mayr is Darwin and he's just carrying on the argument. There's not a ripple in that stream which doesn't flow from the beginning to the end. All the information that's available today, and all of those who study the subject derive most of their understanding from Ernst Mayr, in fact. So I refer to his book from time to time to just get examples and reinforcements that clarify some of Darwin's ideas.
There's no title page on this. What is it?
Okay, the title of this document is History of Evolutionary Theory. And the author is underlined at the end of the article. Yes, right there. And I'm sorry I did not add page numbers before I printed it. There weren't page numbers on it, but when I downloaded it, I should have added page numbers. But Ayala, to continue the historical commentary, is mainly summarizing Mayr. So in those 92 pages, you get these 350 pages plus a couple of previous works of Mayer, all of which are very concisely stated by Ayala. So the introduction that you have is extremely thorough and comprehensive and specific. So if you read that booklet, even if you just read it randomly, you will find that the headings are explained in short paragraphs that really capture the essential information. And the terminology that's used will come up a bit from time to time in this first section. Soon we will move on past Darwinian theory and more into philosophy. But it's important, I think, to tune in a bit to the empirical mind and its enthusiasm for the discovery of this knowledge. And subsequent knowledge has only clarified and amplified these perceptions that the naturalists of the 19th century had. So it's quite a remarkably consistent development of thought based upon more and more and more precise data. There seems to be hardly a gap in that continuum. It's just more and more fully explained.
Has any substantial argument, let's say by creationists or intelligent design people, has any substantial argument against what we're now going to be talking about been made? I know they've made arguments, but these are, in general, just that.
Not as
been defeated or
not as far as I'm aware.
Talk about entropy and
but at the same time, it's an empirical science, and that means that. Would you like to get closer to the fan? So, you know, the philosophical question is, how do we know that this or any other knowledge is the truth? And knowing has an object, it has content. So, does this knowledge, is it true? And does it enable us to really understand reality? And can we then move from that understanding to ethical judgment? Do we become better people as a result of this understanding? And does it further our civilization? You know, these are philosophical questions. So we're taking the subject of evolution from both the scientific and the philosophical standpoint because of its importance. And its importance derives from the fact that science has been totally preoccupied with it for 150 years, and Sri Aurobindo made it the foremost theme of his writing. So if we didn't think it was important before this course began, we should now think it's important. And then we should discover why it's important. What is its importance, really? So the beginning of the course is an exploration of the beginning of the elaboration of the theory, the idea, the discovery, in the words of some of those who are the most articulate. And we will then follow up more scientifically some of their intuitions and observations, and then we'll move on to other levels of understanding and contemplating this content. So we pick up now, we pick up some concepts. We pick up some reflections and associations, ideas concerning the theory of evolution. I handed out last time to some people the first chapter of Ernst Haeckel's book called The Evolution of Man. For just these reasons, just to familiarize ourselves with some of the early thinking on this subject, and Haeckel because he was the foremost early German philosopher of evolution, and
H-A-E-C-K-E-L,
von Haeckel, I suppose.
Haeckel, I don't know, in the south, but in Japanese, it's different. Yeah.
Anyway, many of his illustrations were published in Darwin's books also. He was an embryologist and a very good artist, and has done a lot for the theory of evolution by making hundreds and hundreds of very precise drawings of comparative embryology. And he arrived at a theory all of his own that I think we should briefly review. Leads to some interesting ideas. And Ernst Mayr will tell us that this theory has been refuted, that it's not true. But that's fine. It was interesting and exploratory, and we can learn a lot from it. He said, the history of the germ, the seed, is an epitome of the history of the descent of species. The germ, the embryo, carries the history of the descent of the species. This has become a very common idea. But he points out that at that time, almost no one, except for a few physiologists, doctors, had observed embryos. But he observed a lot of embryos. And he knew every stage of the development of the embryo in many different species. So his theory is actually based upon those empirical observations and thoughts. Or in other words, he says that ontogeny, which is the development of the individual seed, is a recapitulation of phylogeny. And phylogeny is the history of the species, and of other species, and of all species. Or, he says, somewhat more explicitly, the series of forms through which the individual organism passes during its progress from the egg cell to its fully developed state is a brief, compressed reproduction of the long series of forms through which the animal ancestors of that organism, or ancestral forms of its species, have passed from the earliest periods of so-called organic creation down to the present time. This is the theory of that ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny. The causal nature, and this is really interesting, the causal nature of the relation which connects the history of the germ with that of the tribe. And by tribe, as I said, we mean the history of the whole phylum, the descent of the phylum. So what do I do with this now?
X in the X. Or right hand.
Pardon me?
It will disappear.
Just
close it.
Well, I'm not getting a...
There is a mouse. There.
Cursor is not...
Mouse is for you.
Aha, mouse is for me. Okay. So, if we look at some pictures here, which you have in your booklet.
What was that causal...
Yeah, I'm going to go back to that. Okay. So what we can imagine is that the embryo of the animal on the end goes through all of these stages in its development. That's the idea. And there is a causal relation which connects the history of the germ, its embryonic development, with that of the descent of the tribe. And this is a tribe. These are species that are continuous in time, one from the other. We'll see that in a moment. Now, get this. The causal nature of the relation which connects the history of the germ with that of the tribe is dependent on the phenomena of heredity and adaptation. When these are properly understood and their fundamental importance in determining the forms of organisms recognized, we may go a step further and say phylogenesis is the mechanical cause of ontogenesis. These are scientists. They're looking for cause and effect relationships. We can see that it happens. We can see that the embryo is recapitulating all these different stages of the species and other species from which man has descended. How does that happen? How is it possible that the embryo does this? So he decides that it does this because what the parent is the result of all of that, and that somehow, through heredity, because the parent is the result of all of that, it causes that same recapitulation to happen in its offspring. They didn't know about genetics yet, but they knew that
heredity was happening. They knew that adaptation and variation and change were happening, and that everything was related, and they asked themselves the question, how? How does it work? So Haeckel was very imaginative and decided that there was, that heredity was the mechanism, and that it was caused by that history itself being present in the human, in the parent. And then he, later on, he says some other very interesting things. For example, from the fact that the human egg is a simple cell, we may at once infer that there has been, at a very remote time, a unicellular ancestor of the human race, resembling an amoeba. Again, from the fact that the human embryo originally consists merely of two simple germ layers, we may at once safely infer that a very ancient ancestral form is represented by the two-layered gastria, the gastropod, this two-layered involution of cells characterizes the next level of evolution from the amoeba to the gastropod type of organism. A later embryonic form of the human being points with equal certainty to a primitive, worm-like ancestral form which is related to the sea squirts or ascidians of the present day. But the low animal forms which constitute the ancestral line between the unicellular amoeba and the gastria, and further between the gastria and the ascidian form, can only be approximately conjectured with the aid of comparative anatomy and ontogeny. Modern genetics has established, through DNA studies, that our species has descended from worms to gastropods, to starfish, to shrimp, to insects, to coelacanths, to frogs, to shrews. And our most immediate ancestor in our line of evolution before primates were shrews. And this is very well established science.
So does this knowledge further our consciousness?
Yes.
No.
Yes. It's like a rat. It's a long-nosed rat.
Yeah, it's a rodent.
Read Shakespeare's Taming of the Shrew.
So we'll come back to this illustration momentarily. Just wanted to, catch one more thing from. No, this is really remarkable. Haeckel was right, and he got it by observing embryos. And he was so precise. And now it's absolutely certain what this line of development was, and those guys that he discovered were there before us. Oh, I might add that the worm stage of our species was 600 million years ago, and the shrew stage was 80 million years ago, and the starfish stage was 570 million years ago. The coelacanth, that fish with the black background, was only 425 million years ago. And as I said, the shrews were 80 million years ago, around the time of the extinction of dinosaurs. This is the phylogenetic line of the species Chordata, the phylum Chordata, of which we are the most recent species. Phylum Chordata. All these guys have nervous systems, reproductive organs. They have the same genetic makeup as we do, but it has become more complex as time has gone on. And so now it is known exactly at what time in history the hoax gene, for example, which determines the head, the difference between the head and the tail, which does our spatial organization, the hoax gene at the time of worms consisted of one chain, one nucleotide chain, and by the time it duplicated itself again and again and again through the millennia up to our present time, it consists of 38 nucleotide chains. And each of these activates in the cells the development of the organs at the right time in the embryo. And so the gill stage, you know, and the worm stage and the tail stage and all of those stages are there in the embryo as a result of the hoax genes, which stimulate those developments not because the parent, the form of the parent, has carried those forms, because the human species has not had anything to do with those forms, and many times in the embryonic development, forms are missing. You know, that they drop out along the way. They're no longer part of our development. They don't need, you know, like in the whale, for example, there's a stage of embryonic development at which the whale has teeth. But then when it's fully developed, it no longer has teeth, because the whale doesn't need teeth anymore. But in its embryonic development, the teeth are still there. But they may not, I mean, you know, in our development, their embryonic development, there are forms that were extant in the distant past that no longer show up in the embryonic chain. And so almost this entire book is Haeckel trying to explain why they don't show up, because they contradict his theory. The fact that they are not there is very difficult for him to deal with.
Just a quick question. Does he at any point compare embryos of different species with human embryo? And
yes.
How does he read that most embryos are actually the same up to a certain point, and then they specialize it to humans and to the frog? But up to zygotic and embryologic forms are the same.
Yes, he does, and there's a diagram in this book that's very interesting. I don't have a picture of it online, but these are embryos of fish, salamander, tortoise, chicken, pig, cow, rabbit, and human. And they up to one point, they all have the same organs and the same shapes at the same time in their development. So he did lots of drawings like that. The other thing that he was preoccupied with that I want to bring up at this point is this idea. From this theory, we first learn the efficient causes of individual evolution. By the aid of this theory, we first perceive that such mechanical causes alone suffice to effect the evolution of the individual organism, and that the cooperation of designing or teleological causes, final causes, which were formerly universally assumed, is unnecessary. Well, he hasn't actually discovered any efficient causes. He has postulated that the phylogenetic descent of forms causes the stages of embryonic development. But this is a fundamental error in human thought, which was the subject of Hume's philosophy. We infer from related events that recur causal relationships. Even today, it's not known exactly how the hoax genes cause the stages of the development of the organs. Now it's being discovered that on these genes, there are many different areas that produce different chemicals that stimulate different processes. And so there is no clear, direct causal relationship, there is just a very close observable proximity. And so there's experimentation. So the hoax gene has been taken from a mouse and put onto the leg of a fly, and the fly leg grew an eye. You know, and so this gene was taken at the moment when it's supposed to stimulate eye development in a mouse, transplanted into a fly, and it stimulates eye development in the fly. But it doesn't stimulate mouse eye development, it stimulates fly eye development, compound eye. So the hoax gene is universal in the animal kingdom.
H-O-X.
Yeah.
H-O-X or A-X?
X, H-O-X.
it means referring to the
Negro folks.
Yeah, and actually there's a PAX6 gene which is related to the hoax gene which does the eye. But anyway, the idea is that genes are universal and they stimulate development in all species. More complex species have more complex genes which determine the body plans. So the main reason why I put these guys up there is to indicate 6 different body plans. These are distinct phyla. And we'll discuss those phyla in a moment. But they all derived from the same original amoeboid cell. They are not phyla in the parallel sense. They are phyla in the consecutive sense. So they are parallel, they all exist. But in fact, the worm was the earliest in history, and the shrew the latest. And so the evolutionary descent that Haeckel is speaking about, the phylogenetic descent, is pictured there. And in the embryos of each of these, the forms of the prior are present, and many, many more than these. These are just eight.
Right. Just to put it in a further context, can they estimate when the first amoeba was? How far back that
was? Yeah, that's quite well known. It was 3.5 billion years ago, I think.
3.5 billion.
There was a very long period of time, about 2.5 billion years, when there was no change. There were protista, which are prior to one-celled and multi-celled organisms that existed for a couple of billion years. And then there were eukaryotic organisms that existed for a couple of billion years. And then there started to be complex development. So the Precambrian period is 600 million years ago. The main explosion of species from which all subsequent species have evolved was known as the Precambrian period, and it was only 600 million years ago. So for 4 billion years or so, there was not a whole lot of activity in evolution.
But there was life.
There was activity, and there were many, many single-celled organisms. And before that, there were many, many bacteria and viruses. But it wasn't until the Precambrian period that multi-celled species appeared in a very prominent way. And at this point, there are only 38 different phyla. The paleontologists believe that during the Cambrian period there were many more, and many of them didn't survive. So it was a big experiment, and from that period, all existing phyla have descended. But they all had the same original amoeboid ancestor. So then, everyone asked the question about the explosions which took place periodically in time and in relation to extinctions. This is a very prominent field of study today in paleontology, because we know so much now about when things happened in the past. Just since the 60s, so much has been learned about what exactly happened in the past and when. So this information is relatively recent, when each of these species appeared, and it wasn't until Crick and Watson that it was possible to trace all the genetics with molecular biology, all the DNA relationships of all the species. This has been known only in the past 20 years or so. But it's verifying the theories of the past.
When were the first complex plants? When did they arrive?
I have a picture of it. It's in your book. It's in your blue book. At the back. All the illustrations are at the back. And they're minimal, but they're the best ones from the website, or actually from the encyclopedia. You can find lots more if you go into the various websites on evolution. Let me just finish this section from Haeckel and then move on to Darwin. So Haeckel says that now we know the efficient causes, and the final causes, which were formerly universally assumed, are no longer necessary. Of course, then he says, I allude to this matter at this early stage, chapter 1, in order to call attention to one of the most important advances made in any branch of human knowledge during the past 10 years. The history of philosophy shows that in the cosmology of our day, as in that of antiquity, final causes are almost universally deemed to be the real ultimate causes of the phenomena of organic life, and especially those of the life of man. The prevailing doctrine of design, or teleology. Teleology means the future is determined by something which exists, which is a purpose. Everything evolves and develops because of a purpose which is already there, called the final cause. So we ended our talk last time with this idea, Aristotle's idea. There's the material cause, the efficient cause, the formal cause, and he's speaking about formal causes here, and the final cause. Well, curiously enough, he is saying that the formal cause is the efficient cause. That the forms, let me read it exactly here. The prevailing doctrine of teleology assumes that the phenomena of organic life and those of evolution are explicable only by purposive causes, and that, on the contrary, they in no way admit of a mechanical explanation. The most difficult problems in this respect, which have been before us, and which seemed capable of solution only by means of teleology, are precisely those which have been mechanically solved in the theory of descent. We shall see in the course of our inquiries how, through Darwin's reform of the doctrine of evolution, the most wonderful problems, hitherto deemed unapproachable, of the organization of man and animals, have admitted to a natural solution. I just wanted to emphasize something that he says about formal cause. The series of forms through which the individual organism passes during its progress from the egg to its fully developed state is a brief, compressed reproduction of the long series of forms through which the animal ancestors of that organism have passed from the earliest periods. The causal nature of the relation which connects the history of the germ with that of the tribe. The forms of the past create causally the development of the embryo. And so the shrew form creates in the next shrew body the same form by heredity. And if the shrew body evolves for some reason, if it diverges and becomes another species, then that new form will create a reproduction of itself through heredity. This is, in fact, the doctrine of formal causes, that the human being always creates more human beings because there is a human being form that we all embody. And the geranium always reproduces geraniums because there's a geranium form out there in the universe which creates all geraniums. This is the Platonic, the idea of the of Platonic forms applied to scientific understanding. Nobody in science believes that the form of the human or the form of the geranium is out there in the universe causing all of these humans to look alike, more or less. But there is the idea that types, the different species, are somehow fixed and recreate, reproduce their type in their offspring. It's a common notion from based on experience. That's what we see happening. So, on that note, I want to switch to Darwin.
You said that Mayer said that Haeckel was wrong in some way?
He said that on the theory that ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny is wrong because it's not causal.
It's not?
Causal. The fact that the shrew ancestors passed through these and many other stages is not what causes the shrew embryo to recapitulate some of those stages. In fact, many of them aren't there. It's the host genes which cause it. The forms themselves don't cause anything, according to genetic theory. But we can hold that idea in suspension for some time, because what we observe is that forms do in fact reproduce themselves. And so Aristotle speaks about the formal cause, the efficient cause, and the material cause. Well, the material cause is the genes, the efficient cause is the sperm and the egg, and the formal cause is that the product actually looks like the parent. You know? So in fact, these are still perceptible principles.
And the final cause?
And the final cause, of course, is the divine life, the supermind, the good. And, you know, Plato defined the good as similar to the way Sri Aurobindo defines the supermind. It's a linguistic, that's a linguistic question, wrong class.
It's a
language, it's a function of poetry.
But it's not part of the...
Not part of biology.
It's
a word which has a sound, onomatopoeia.
Bang!
Okay, so...
I wanted to ask something.
Yeah.
When I was small, I was always wondering why all the shrimps didn't evolve they still exist in the earth.
Yeah.
Always I had this question, never had an answer. Probably we have to eat those shrimps, and that's why they exist. It's in the Bible, actually.
Everything's in the Bible.
So, how come they exist still and they don't evolve?
Right. Well, it's only because you have such a limited time frame that you don't think that they evolved. And that's exactly what I was coming to right now. Darwin says, the many slight differences which appear in the offspring from the same parents, or which it may be presumed have thus arisen, from being observed in the individuals of the same species, inhabiting the same confined locality, may be called individual differences. No one supposes that all the individuals of the same species are cast in the same actual mold. These individual differences are of the highest importance for us, for they are often inherited, as must be familiar to everyone. And they thus afford materials for natural selection to act on and accumulate In the same manner as man accumulates in any given direction individual differences in his domesticated productions. These individual differences generally affect what naturalists consider unimportant parts. But I could show by a long catalogue of facts that parts which must be called important, whether viewed under a physiological or a classificatory point of view, sometimes vary in the individuals of the same species. Important parts also vary. For example, the brain of 5 generations of human beings isn't the same in each generation. Neither is the location of the moles and freckles on the skin. The brain is very important. The moles and freckles are not. We notice those unimportant changes. This is empirical observation. We don't notice the changes in the location of the nasal membranes. But some offspring of people with sinus conditions don't have sinus conditions, and so on. So then he says, it should be remembered that the systematists, that those who classify species, are far from being pleased at finding variability in important characters. Because of this propensity for thinking that species don't change over generations. The shrew has always been there since we were first brought from Europe to India in the Spanish galleons. The shrews have been there. They haven't changed in the last 400 or 500 years. The grasshoppers haven't changed, and the potatoes haven't changed. So they must be eternal. And it's much easier for classification if they are eternal. But then he says, they are not pleased at finding variability in important characters, and that there are not many men who will laboriously examine internal and important organs and compare them in many specimens of the same species. Authors sometimes argue in a circle when they state that important organs never vary. For these same authors practically rank those parts as important which do not vary perceptibly. So they argue in a circle. And under this point of view, no instance will ever be found of an important part varying. But under any other point of view, many instances assuredly can be given. I'm going to jump. I wanted to speak a little bit about inherited effects, but I think I'll keep that for next time, because the topic that emerges most directly from this discussion is the topic of homologous parts in different species that have varied. And there's quite an excellent example of homologous parts that have varied. Here. These are turtle fingers, dolphin fingers, human fingers, horse fingers, bat fingers, and chicken fingers. And so the idea of variation is that under changing conditions of survival, of nature, in one species there will be a gradual selection of those members of the species who have begun to vary and to diversify in an advantageous way. And at some point, there will be a divergence through gradual, minimal changes in a bone structure like this. There will eventually be an advantage to some members of the species that have developed longer or shorter fingers. And you can see this very clearly. Notice the horse. The horse is assigned digit 4 and digit 3. Right? Whereas the human has all 5, the dolphin has all 5, the turtle has all 5, the bat has all 5, the chicken has only 3. Let's look at horse leg development through time. $55 million ago, this was the horse which had these 4 digits. 40 million years ago, this horse had these 3 digits here and one there. 25 million years ago, the horse had these 3 digits, but they were changing significantly. And as of 5 million years ago, our horse had the 3rd digit, the 2nd, and the 4th digit. So at this point, when the horse was only 2.5 feet tall, and was probably still, was not far away from the time when he was a shrew, and when he used his fingers to hold things, gradually found that his teeth were developing for biting off from trees, and so he didn't need those grasping fingers anymore. And so those who had better and better developed jaws and hooves for running so that they could get away from predators faster were the ones that survived. And in good museums in the West today, you can see all of these reconstructed bone structures. There are many fossils of all of these stages of the horse available these days, and you can study them. So homologous development of important parts has occurred across the members of a species like this, and has eventually become one like this, and it has eventually become one like this, and 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 like this, through the gradual differentiation by adaptation communicated by heredity to the offspring, natural selection of those forms which were most advantageous, eventual divergence. And if very successful, something called radio adaptation takes place, And there are a large number of related species with similar homologous development that share different niches. And so they are no longer so competitive with each other. And then each of those can vary slightly and diverge into other varieties. So nature has figured out how to make the principle of diversity most advantageous. And all of those diverse developments share one common genetic structure. Sri Aurobindo has a term for this, I think.
Unity and diversity.
Unity and diversity, right, that's it. So, looking at the evolution of the eye is very, very interesting. This is an example of that kind of development. This is the earliest eye in the light receptor pigment spot of a one-celled animal. And then gradually this folds in, the photoreceptor folds in and begins to build a cavity over it for catching directional light. This becomes a lens, a refractive lens, and eventually this retina becomes very diversified, and the iris and the cornea develop, and the fully developed eye emerges over a period of a billion years, because those light pigment spots were there in early eukaryote species. And the eye, according to these recent studies of DNA, the eye has developed independently in 40 different species. So this, for me, raises a very significant question when we speak about material, efficient, formal, and final causes. Yes, the genetic process has been at work to create in every generation slight variations, some of which get selected and become divergent species or divergent subspecies or divergent varieties, like we have so many in the human species right now, so many varieties of humans, so many varieties of roses and so many varieties of shellfish and so on. The efficient cause, of course, is the same in all of them. It's the germ, the sperm and the egg. And the sperm and the egg, which respond to changes in temperature and all kinds of stimuli from the environment, proximity, beauty, whatever. The formal cause, which is the reproduction of an almost identical offspring, similar in many ways, with eyes that see for the purpose of protection, for the purpose of spatial orientation, for the purpose of recognizing friends. And finally, we have the idea, I would suggest, that we can derive from this sequence the idea that sight for whatever purpose it applies at any particular level of development, sight is a final cause, the principle of sight. The principle of sight has been present throughout. The principle of hearing has been present throughout. The principle of taste was there from the beginning. Smell emerged very early. And the composite of these senses is consciousness. Sight is an instrument of consciousness. Touch is an instrument of consciousness. It allows the amoeba to know when it's getting into hot water. So I would suggest that the five senses and the composite sixth sense qualify as final causes. But you're never going to discover that by studying genetics. By studying genetics, you will find that it's the same gene which has created the eye formation in all 40 different phyla. That gene is ubiquitous. But the impact that it has on the form depends upon all the other forms. So one of the things I wanted to read from Darwin is a little paragraph about what he calls correlated evolution, correlated development. What he observes in the embryonic and larval stage of the development of any individual or any species is that there are many different features of the species which develop together. One is connected to the other, and they keep being together. So there's a set of correlated organs in each phylum, and they emerge in the development of the embryo at the same time in every offspring, and so the hoax gene is also coordinating the development of different organs in each species according to the plan of that species. And so Haeckel and others in the German school at that time came up with the idea of the Bow Plan. The Bow Plan is the blueprint of the body. And so it turns out that there are about 38 of those corresponding to 38 different patterns of hoax genes. And in existence today, there are only about 38 different body plans, and about 20 of them are prominent and recognizable, and the others, you would say, are so close that they're not different. And when Cuvier came up with this idea in the 19th century, he said there were four body plans, and then it became the eight, which I have shown you a picture of, more or less distinct body plans. And then as biological studies became more refined and more fossils were collected and subspecies were studied and genetics were studied, finally today it's generally agreed that there are about 38 different body plans. But there are these eight fundamental ones that are very similar. They're all symmetrical, but the symmetry works a little bit differently in each of them. So I could draw quickly an example
of some body plans that are roughly related and symmetrical. And this shows how closely related are all species, in addition to genetics. This idea that that there's a bivalve there's the starfish. There's this guy. And he is symmetrical, ventrically symmetrical. All of these are our ancestors. There's this guy, who is kind of like this. And then obviously then, you know, there's this guy who we know so well. and he shows us, like this guy shows us, the typical higher level of body plan development that we all are familiar with, the head, the thorax, and the abdomen. So insects had it first. We're closely related to the annelid, this guy. Who also has a kind of spiral, symmetrical body with an early notochord, an early form of the vertebrae runs through this guy. So each of these diversified and diversified and became this one, you know, became this one and this one. Became this one, and this one became that one, and that one became that one, and that one became that one, and but through long periods of very gradual homologous variations. This appearance we call the phenotype. The appearance and the behavior is known as the phenotype. The genetic pattern that stimulates the development of this guy, we call the genotype. And Ernst Mayr tells us in this book, and Lewontin, another Harvard biologist, tells us today, we still don't know how the genes actually cause these body plans, these phenotypes, to develop. So I had said in the first meeting, if we can come to some understanding of the relationship between the genotype and the phenotype, just like in linguistics, if we can come to some understanding of the relationship between syntactical structure and meaning, if we can somehow relate spirit and matter meaningfully, directly, we solve a big puzzle. Our whole dualistic system of thinking and not thinking, self, our idea of self and other, our idea that our minds and our bodies are not related, our idea that we're all separate species, phyla, individuals, our basic structure of understanding is just reflected and symbolized by this aporia, this problem of how do we relate the outer to the inner, the most basic to the most elaborate. We see that they're related, whether we're embryologists or linguists or artists, we feel the interconnectedness and the relatedness, and yet we don't know what really connects the structure and the consciousness, the genome and the phenome, the inner and the outer, the spiritual and the material. This helps us to understand that they are connected, and that not only is the body plan of this guy connected to the body plan of that guy, but the consciousness of this guy is connected to the consciousness of that guy. Consciousness, sight, sound, orientation, understanding, response, that has evolved in these structures. And it has served nature. Nature has decided that the horse hoof needs to get more efficient for running, and the horse jaw needs to get more efficient for biting. Nature knew that. You know, and she didn't create some other weird thing. She created something that follows directly from the previous thing. There's a constraint. You know, those important parts, it's true, they don't diversify as much as the unimportant parts. They diversify very slowly and incrementally. So we don't suddenly get born without hearts without first learning how to breathe yogically. You know, that new heart is not going to just appear in one of our offsprings. It's going to be evolved slowly through intention, that new breathing that she speaks of. So our consciousness is picking up the idea, it's becoming an intention, and when we get to Sri Aurobindo, we'll do a little deconstruction of Darwin and see if we can discover something about the relationship between the future and the past, the inner and the outer, the higher and the lower structures of consciousness. Same thing. It's the same thing. The inner and the outer, the higher and the lower. Same thing. But we don't see it. We don't perceive it. We have an idea about it. All of the evidence points to it. But we're not quite on that point of actually grasping directly the unity of the genome and the phenome, the inner and the outer. That's a step in consciousness. And all of this information that people are discovering and organizing and communicating is part of that process of making that step. It's okay. Good enough for tonight.
So, one quick question, just to clarify. So, when modern medicine deems genetics some kind of illness, I want to assume that they know nothing and that it's labeled genetic, what they don't know.
Well, they do know quite a bit. By experimentation. you know, like you can transplant that gene into that organism and see that this happens. So the difficulty is that many of the genes are related, and so this correlated evolution happens. And it's very difficult for them now that they know what's there, to decide what combination is related to what inner combination is related to what outer combination. And so they can isolate some genes which are definitely directly responsible for some behaviors, by which I mean also growth. But the big picture is much more complex than anyone realized. Where they are trying to focus is on those diseases which are genetically inherited, but which come up after the reproductive period of life. Nature can work on eliminating diseases during the reproductive period of life. But things like Alzheimer's, which come after the reproductive period, don't get selected out by natural selection. And so if that gene can be isolated and treated, it's the only way to remove it from the evolutionary status. So that's an interesting direction that genetic medicine is exploring.
To some extent, we argue that Alzheimer's also has a cultural and social background to it, just genetic.
Probably. Today, everyone accepts that all of matter is evolving. But you know,
but
it was.
Because the causes of it, consciousness is evolving, that's why the matter is evolving.
No one knows the cause of it.
No one knows.
Well, but you should have said so.
Yeah, well, I could sing you a little song about what we learned in Bible school also.
Well, Bible was a little late.
I mean, you know, when I say no one knows the cause, I mean that it's not yet part of our consciousness. We have some theories about it. Okay, we have spiritual theories, and we have biological theories, and all kinds of theories. And we more or less believe or disbelieve based on evidence, one or the other, or several of those theories. That's exactly what Darwin and Haeckel were doing. They were intuiting the truth about nature. And they were right, up to a point. But even today, their school of thought will say, we don't have anything to say about the origin of life. And we don't have anything to say about the purpose of evolution, except that nature appears to improve her products for the sake of survival. And that there are mechanisms that are better and better understood about how she does that. That's as far as they will go.
But
then,
interesting thing what happened to me once, I met two people, biologists, who had no spiritual background, but when I talked to them about this, what I know as a background from pure window, as if from the biology itself, from nature or creation, they could imagine that we are not just end of it. This was quite interesting for me, that a relatively normal scientist without a spiritual background or religious says, why should we draw a stop here? As if this much that we already see from this whole movement.
There's a large school of scientists and technologists in America who believe that their discoveries will eventually lead to the revelation, the apocalypse. And they're inspired, the mind synthesizes all of this information, and suddenly it's inspired because it has achieved a synthesis and a unification of understanding that makes it resonant with the universe. And then it says, wow, science is really approaching God. And Sri Aurobindo said, yes, science will really approach God. And at some point, there will be a convergence. And the higher intuition and the analytical, rational, scientific will understand that they are part of the same knowing, and then there will be more understanding, better understanding of everything. There are already plenty of scientists who operate in that intermediate zone, the higher mind zone.
There's also a whole bunch of